The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron, delivering gourmet recipes and fresh ingredients right to your door. Listeners get their first three meals free at blueapron.com/takeaway. That's blueapron.com/takeaway.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. A look at that other failed state in the Middle East. Airstrikes like this one are a daily event in Yemen as the Saudi-led war against Yemen seems to be escalating. The Shia-aligned Houthi militia are said to be loyal to Iran and are battling Saudis for control in a nation that is being systematically demolished by the parties that say they want to save it. Weapon sales from the U.S. and Britain keep this conflict going ever since President Ali Abdullah Saleh was unseated during the Arab Spring uprising in 2011. On Monday, airstrikes at a Doctors Without Border facility in Yemen left several people dead. This came on the heels of similar airstrikes on a school and food factory, which left more than two dozen dead, mostly women and children. United Nations peace talks have failed for now here, and with no clear scenario forward, this other failed state looks like the battlefield in a regional war, an internal grab for power, and a civilian catastrophe. Iona Craig is a journalist who has covered the conflict in Yemen extensively. She's an investigative journalist for The Intercept.
Yemen's conflict became a part of the regional tussle between Saudi Arabia and Iran as soon as the Saudis became involved in March last year. But the battle really began even before that. There had been conflict on the ground already. Even the first airstrikes and first bombs weren't dropped by the Saudis. Those were carried out by the Yemeni Air Force against the current President Hadi. But yes, as soon as the Saudis got involved, they saw the Houthis, the rebel forces on the ground, as being backed by Iran. Of course, it sucked Yemen into that regional battle now that is seen between Saudi Arabia and Iran elsewhere in the region.
What do the Saudis want to see as some sort of stable eventual outcome in Yemen?
Well, I think their aim at the moment is obviously for that not to be a country ruled by the Houthis. They are a predominantly Zaydi Shia movement. And as I mentioned, you know, they very much see them as being a proxy for Iran, if anything, although the extent of that influence is very unclear and lacks a lot of evidence and certainly isn't as extensive as the Saudis often make out. So, yes, this obviously, you know, builds into a narrative, really, and gives them something to play with, really, in that regional power struggle, if you like to call it, or certainly that regional rivalry between Iran and Saudi Arabia that we've seen building over the last few years.
What is the cost of all this in civilian lives, in lives disrupted, in ways of life that will never be restored?
In Yemen, that's really the most depressing part of it. You've got nearly 3 million people now who've been internally displaced by this conflict. You've got more, you know, 80% of the population now in need of some form of humanitarian aid. This is the poorest country in the Middle East. It was already suffering before this conflict, but now the levels of malnutrition are going through the roof. Access to areas to get food and supplies to people is incredibly difficult. There has been a naval blockade imposed on the country by the Saudi-led coalition to prevent weapons getting into the Houthis, but that also prevents food getting in when Yemen relies on imports for 90% of its food supplies. So, yes, it's really the civilians that are bearing the brunt of this conflict. You know, the latest figures are of over 3,500 civilians have been killed in this war so far, predominantly by airstrikes from the Saudi-led coalition. And now we've seen an intensification again of the conflict in the last 10 days. Once again, we're seeing civilians really being the main casualties of that at the moment.
What do you make of the targeting, if that could be said, of medical facilities in this war?
Yes, I've seen it firsthand on the ground myself, and it's been it's been blatant. The attack you refer to on the MSF hospital, which left at least 11 people dead, including one of their medical staff, one of their staff in the hospital, and another 19 injured. That was just 48 hours after a school had been bombed, which had killed 10 children under the age of 15, which was on the same day as a school's principal's house being bombed, where four children and relatives were killed. And the list goes on. That attack on the MSF hospital yesterday was the fourth attack against a MSF-supported health facility just in the last year.
And both the UK and the United States are supplying weapons to Saudi Arabia that are used in this conflict. Is that not the case?
Yes. I mean, both America and the UK have been making billions of dollars out of this war. The US has sold $20 billion worth of bombs and military equipment and in services to the Saudis over the course of the last year. The UK has also been making, you know, billions of dollars in arms sales and in fighter jet sales to the Saudis over the years. So, yeah, this is big business for the UK and the US. We've seen that continued support both in a military sense and on the diplomatic front as well, despite the violations of international humanitarian law that have been called out by the humanitarian organisations. It doesn't really sit very well when you've got, you know, the West, whether it's the UK or the US, criticising both the Syrian government and the Russians for bombing civilian targets in Syria. And while in Saudi Arabia, the same thing's going on, but it's being done with US and UK bombs, it probably explains why they remain pretty silent about things going on in Yemen and yet still refuse to stop selling those weapons. So, yeah, it's viewed very much in Yemen as an involvement in a US-supported war and a UK-supported war as much as a Saudi war.
Iona Craig is a journalist who spent many years covering Yemen. She's an investigative reporter for The Intercept. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
President Obama announced this week the transfer of 15 Gitmo Guantanamo Bay detainees, the single largest transfer of prisoners since Guantanamo became the historically famous, globally unprecedented U.S. judicial netherworld in the war on terror. Carol Rosenberg, a journalist who's closely followed the infamous military prison for years, reporting for the Miami Herald, joins us. Carol, how did you get the news?
I'd been hearing about this big transfer for some time, John. This is the first of what we expect to be perhaps up to 20 more in coming weeks. And while this isn't the end of the story, this is really a dramatic moment for Guantanamo. They basically have shut down all media opportunity, the detention center, till October. So I expect by then we could have a tiny little detainee population of maybe 40-something or 50 prisoners from an all-time high of about 660 in 2003.
And right now it stands at 61 with the 15 who are bound for somewhere in the Gulf?
They arrived in the UAE over the weekend. It was a secret operation. Gitmo likes its secret operations. They flew them out Saturday night.
And they will stay there indefinitely. Are there any conditions to their remaining in the UAE?
So a dozen are Yemeni and three are Afghans, and those 15 men can't go home. The UAE has set up, I'm told, I haven't seen it, a rehabilitation program, residential. Somebody described it as, at the start, quasi-detention, meaning, you know, they're not going to be on the streets of Abu Dhabi anytime soon, but they are going to be in a program that will evolve into halfway house living, and then at some point, what we would consider freedom. The issue that I have not been able to resolve is, do they get travel documents? Can they leave the country, the Emirates? But they're going to start off in a setting that should reassure people who are afraid that they've just been let loose, and then they're going to evolve into something that should allow them to set up new lives, get wives, have families. And I'm told that they will get family visits in the Emirates.
Now, there are also some of us who are concerned that they not just be sent to a facility where they're just kind of dumped and tortured endlessly for one reason or another. Are there assurances that they will be treated in a way that leads to the kind of freedom you're talking about?
I haven't seen the assurances, but I think that when you deal with a country like the UAE, the evolution to get them out of this setting is inevitable. They're not interested, as I understand it, in having a, you know, Guantanamo East. They're interested in helping these people get to new lives. It's not going to help UAE is a very stable country, but you don't want to have a setting like that. So their goal is to help them figure out how to get out of the rehab center into, again, halfway houses. And then if Oman, which has a similar program, is any indication, let them, particularly for the Yemenis, let their family send them wives and let them have apartments and help them get jobs.
Any quid pro quo here that we know anything about? And I can't imagine you know the answer to this question, but I'll ask it anyway.
I don't know the answer to that question. I mean, what I can tell you is that President Obama has put a lot of effort into talking to the GCC, the Gulf Cooperation Council countries, and getting their help in getting out of this Guantanamo problem. You know, the Yemenis, as your previous guest made clear, they can't go back to Yemen. The place is just a wreck of a country, and nobody wants former al-Qaeda or people who may at this point be somewhat sympathetic to al-Qaeda ending up in Yemen. So Obama reached out. Oman stood up and took 20 Yemenis, huge number of people. We understand that that is a program that is allowing evolution into private life. The Saudis took 9 Yemenis, in addition to more than 100 Saudis that were returned through the years, mostly by the Bush administration. Now the UAE has a total of 20 former Guantanamo detainees, 3 of them Afghans, whom the chairman of the Joint Chief of Staff didn't want sent back to Afghanistan, and the rest are Yemeni.
Now, did these individuals bypass some judicial tribunal process that was taking place? Was it interrupted and it basically said, okay, go here now? Or just, were these in a special status?
Sorry, just the opposite. No, these are men who have been cleared
right
through a series of parole-style reviews and proceedings. In some instances, 6 of them were cleared by 2009, and some of them probably in the Bush years. But because they were Yemeni, they had nowhere to go, so there was no incentive to figure out how to get them out of there. There's this parole board kind of thing that was set up called the Periodic Review Board. It has representatives of the Justice Department, the Director of National Intelligence, the Joint Chief of Staff, the State Department, Homeland Security, and the Secretary of Defense. And they look at the files. They make recommendations. In some of these instances, it was recommended that these men be sent to Arabic-speaking countries because they look at the 14 or so years they've lost at Guantanamo, and they want the best chance for them to get on with their lives and not become that recidivist figure that everybody fears and that Congress is so preoccupied with from the Bush years, when it looks like so many of the detainees were not properly settled and did end up, as they say, back on the battlefield.
So from limbo for years to the UAE, Carol Rosenberg, reporter from the Miami Herald, thank you so much.
Thank you, John.
More and more people are using more and more of the ocean, so the pressures have ramped up.
My favorite thing about the ocean is the sound of the waves.
I realized I came across more plastic bags than fish.
Go to the beach and fly my kite and go on the boardwalk.
The more science we do, the bigger this problem appears.
If we don't conserve the oceans, it would be really terrible.
It'd be super heartbreaking.
Unfathomable to me.
It keeps us alive. Protecting nature is the best investment we can make.
Trashing the High Seas, our series on the troublesome relationship between humanity and the life-giving oceans. We know today that oceans are the ecosystem of last resort. You drop it, dump it, flush it, rinse it, drain it, even recycle it. And some of it ends up in the oceans. You can see the historical document of human, industrial, and consumer waste down through the ages by looking at the oceans. Old-style pull tabs, thick glass and plastic, old toys, styrofoam in every shape. How to clean it up? Plastics, litter, all sorts of debris that have polluted our water since the beginning of civilization. Could a robot come to the rescue here? Scientist Boyan Slat has designed a barrier that could collect and remove trash from the Pacific Ocean without disrupting marine life. The founder and CEO of the Ocean Cleanup came up with this idea to clean up the oceans while diving in Greece at just 16 years of age, when he came across more plastic bags than fish. Since then, he's dedicated countless hours to the project. If all goes as planned, 22-year-old Slot and his team hope to collect almost half of the remnants in the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, which spans waters from the west coast of America to Japan. It's over 150 million pounds of trash in just 10 years. Slot is currently testing his prototype in the North Sea, and it's pretty hard to miss.
It's sort of like a long floating curtain, which is about 5 feet above the water and 5 feet below the water, and acts like an artificial coastline there where there is no coastline. Ocean currents in the area, they rotate, so it doesn't stay in one spot. And we are basically making use of that movement to let the plastic hit the barrier. And because this barrier is in a V-shape, the plastic gets pushed towards the center. And once in the center, it's so dense you can hardly see the water. And that's the spot where we can then easily take it out and store it before we ship it to land for recycling.
What's to say fish and wildlife and marine life won't get caught in this or decide to build homes in it or suddenly decide, you know, it doesn't care about plastic. This is a great place for me to, you know, lay my eggs.
Because we don't use any nets, we use these non-permeable screens. There really shouldn't be a reason why we would collect any sea life. The current would flow underneath these barriers, and that would take away all the neutrally buoyant material, including things like fish and plankton. And we actually have a prototype of our system here off the coast of the Netherlands right now. And also there, we didn't observe any negative interaction between sea life and the structure. So we expect that not to be a problem, but we will certainly continue to monitor it because obviously the whole reason why we're doing this is because we want to solve a problem.
What waste would this miss? In other words, what future engineers will have to deal with the rest of the filth that we dump into the ocean?
So there are some pieces that are too small to be extracted, for sure. Our models now show that it's somewhere between about a tenth and half an inch, approximately. What we see is that when we go out there and we do these expeditions to really map the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, was that actually about 98% of the mass of the plastic is still in objects larger than that threshold, meaning that we can actually collect most of it.
And is there any way of disposing of this plastic that actually doesn't also hurt the environment?
We've shown that it's technically possible to recycle this ocean plastic. There are also applications for plastic that aren't by definition harmful. I don't think it would be a good idea to use this plastic to make, for example, new bottles or new plastic bags, because those objects have a high likelihood of entering the ocean again. But I think when you look at objects like car bumpers or chairs, things like that, that's a rather durable way of using plastic and storing it with a very small chance of entering the oceans, because that's not the type of objects that we come across in the middle of the ocean.
Isn't the ocean supposed to just take everything that we dish out? Isn't it kind of a natural system capable of rolling with the punches?
The unique thing about this is that the plastic is persistent, so it doesn't go away by itself. In the early days, you know, a lot of the impact we had as humans, it was sort of temporal, and the stuff would disappear after a while by itself. Plastic is unique in the sense that it doesn't go away by itself, and actually, as we now see, becomes more harmful over time. And this is something that we only started using on a large scale in the 1950s. The consumption grew exponentially. And now that has the results that it has a side effect, which is that millions of tons of plastic enter the oceans each year.
Who was amazed by what you managed to do here? Because it occurs to me, and part of your motivation for this project is that nobody is cleaning up the ocean, that everyone just goes, oh, well, nothing we can do about that. And you've taken it upon yourself to really to go here. I would think there would be a number of skeptics involved in ocean cleaning, and you may have encountered them.
At first, there were certainly some people who were saying that it's impossible and that we should focus on prevention. Sometimes you still come across those arguments. I really think the only way to show that it can be done is to go out there and try it. And that's why we're doing this very iterative development program at this point in time.
If the best case scenario transpires here, what would you expect in the next 10 years?
In a few years from now, we'll be ready to start cleaning up the ocean. And then at some point in time, I also hope to do a bit of work on the prevention side as well. I think developing spin-off technologies of what we're doing in the ocean to also work, for example, closer to land or something, I think that can really complement and will get us to a future in which the oceans are clean again, perhaps within 10, 15 years from now.
Well, it's very optimistic and very ambitious and very Dutch, I would say, with a little American spice in there. Boyan Slat, thank you so much.
All right. No, thank you.
Boyan Slat is the creator of the Ocean Cleanup Array and CEO and founder of the Ocean Cleanup. It's a foundation dedicated to developing advanced technologies to rid the ocean of floating and distributed plastic. To see photos and video from the missions carried out by the Ocean Cleanup, and to stay up to date with our full series, head over to thetakeaway.org/oceans.
Welcome to the world of the plastic beach. Welcome to the world of the plastic beach.
The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron, who knows that incredible ingredients make incredible meals. Blue Apron works with a community of artisanal suppliers, family-run farms, sustainable fisheries, and ethical ranchers to deliver perfectly portioned seasonal ingredients and easy-to-follow recipe cards right to your door. Choose recipes based on your preferences with no weekly commitment. Get your first three Blue Apron meals free, plus free shipping, by visiting blueapron.com/takeaway.
Are levels of mental illness rising, or are the ways in which we communicate and the digital trails we leave behind reveal much more about people in trouble? They become something of a stage for people in trouble to act out, to end things with an audience, so we're much more aware of it. These are among the questions facing mental health professionals as the whole field is changing, along with how people are thinking about mental illness these days. The numbers say that the U.S. suicide rates are the highest in 30 years. If you tell your phone that you're feeling suicidal, the voice of Siri is programmed to direct you to the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. Dr. Joseph Franklin is assistant professor of psychology at Florida State University, and he's gone one better. He has a game-like app called Therapeutic Evaluation Conditioning, or TechTech, he calls it. He thinks it could be the next big thing in mental health care. TechTech uses reliable Pavlovian conditioning techniques to modify potentially suicidal behaviors. Preliminary tests of his app reduced self-cutting episodes, suicide plans, and suicidal behaviors, sometimes as much as 77%.
We don't really have any really effective treatments for suicidal behaviors. No medications really work. Hospitalizing people doesn't really work. And some of our best, most promising treatments like cognitive behavior therapies and variations on that may work, but the evidence is still quite mixed on some of those. So one of the major things that we did was go back to a recent theory actually proposed by Dr. Thomas Joyner at Florida State, where he said that one of the major things involved in the process of serious suicidal behavior was having a capability to engage in those behaviors, which was really defined primarily as a fearlessness about death and suicide. And what we found is that the people who were more at risk did have this capability. And what this app essentially does is it lowers their capability.
What do I see, though, if I call your app up at a moment of crisis?
It's a little bit more of a preventative tool than an active intervening in that particular moment. It's essentially a matching game that has a variety of types of pictures, some pleasant, some unpleasant, some related to suicide and self-injury, and some not. And their goal is to, make their way through this game. It takes 1 to 2 minutes to do it as quickly as possible to get as many points as possible. And so what it really seeks to do is change some of the fundamental associations that they have with things. And one of the primary things that we're trying to change their associations with is death, suicide, and self-injury in general. And so, for example, if I showed you a picture of someone who just cut their arm up or who had just burned themselves alive, you'd find it very aversive, and so would I. Finding those kinds of pictures and stimuli very aversive really acts as an important barrier that keeps us from engaging those behaviors, even if we actually wanted to do them. But what we know based on some of our studies is that people who are most at risk for actually engaging in suicidal behaviors actually regard those kinds of really aversive stimuli as being pretty neutral or sometimes even very pleasant. And so what this app does on a very basic level is it rebuilds that barrier by having them associate those things with fear and disgust.
You know, a lot of people say that the existence that we have with our digital devices is we're, you know, disengaged from face-to-face, human-to-human contact, and that that kind of an existence can encourage, you know, depression, low self-esteem, and essentially suicide. Are you worried that an app is part of the problem as opposed to part of the solution?
I think that a lot of people would also argue that social media really does a great job of connecting a lot of people as well, and connecting a lot of people who otherwise might not have had the same sorts of connections. I think in terms of app-based treatment being more of a problem than a help, I think that the cost-benefit ratio on that is firmly in the category of it being a huge positive because of the huge imbalance in the number of mental health care professionals that we have on the ground compared to the number of people that need help. Even if all mental health care professionals practice 100% effective therapy all of the time, it would still only make a small dent in the national rates. So what the question I ask is, if clinical psychology and psychiatry didn't exist before today, what would we do? How would we study mental disorders and how would we go about treating them? I personally don't think that we would first go to, you know, one-on-one in a room. I think that we would go to technologies from the scaling to the speed to the flexibility can really greatly amplify any actual progress that we're able to make.
So from the consumer angle, what's the next step for your app? What kind of support do you think you might get from partners who would take it to 2.0?
We always want for it to be 100% free to the public and consumers and anyone who would be interested, because our hope is not to make money. Our hope is to actually, you know, see the first large-scale declines in suicidal behavior in 100 years. And to do that, what we really want to do is partner with industries to start developing a whole range of technologies that really improve our large-scale risk detection and ability to prevent this. We have a long way to go.
Really great to talk to you. And the name of this app is?
Therapeutic Evaluative Conditioning, but on the app stores, it would be TechTech, TEC-TEC.
You know, you really should work on that name, Joe. Dr. Joe Franklin is Assistant Professor of Psychology at Florida State University. If the others heard me talking out loud, they would think that I'm crazy.
I'm not crazy. And since I am not crazy, I don't care what anybody thinks.
I may not be as strong as I think, but I know many tricks, and I have resolution. So wrote Ernest Hemingway, his words spoken there by Anthony Quinn in the movie of his short novel, The Old Man and the Sea. It's a story of an unburdening of a troubled man's heart that is a classic of American literature. But all the unburdenings of a writer could not prevent the unraveling that took Hemingway's life by his own hand in a cabin in Idaho in 1961. Three of Hemingway's siblings killed themselves. His father did, as did his granddaughter, Margot. Margot's sister, Meryl, is very much alive. If people think she is crazy, she really does not care. And she has a few tricks that might explain her strength. She's committed to living well. Meryl Hemingway is an Academy Award-nominated actress, author, and activist who came early to the notion that it is the secrets in families that make mental health so tragic and often fatal.
I don't see that violence was the issue in my family, except for the fact that I think that any time that you're repressing stuff and going into addictive behavior, that's violence towards a self, but that's a different conversation. I think that repression and not talking about something creates a tremendous more amount of discomfort and mental illness and imbalance. Currently, there's just so many obstacles. There's so many things that are creating imbalances. It's just, it's a very, very complicated and complex issue. And it becomes more and more complicated as we kind of forge ahead, not really addressing the source.
I wonder if things would be simpler, if a lot of these problems would be simpler, if we had a better language for talking about our feelings, our angers, the things that make us fearful, racial issues. I just think that we have such a primitive language for talking about the things that really are in the headlines. And
absolutely. I think you're absolutely correct. And I think that you nailed it when you said it, all of these things are based in fear. And the reason why we can't speak about them is because it's locked up in a construct of fear. And people, you know, by the very nature of fear, we don't want to talk about those things that scare us. But I have now had many years of undoing the idea that I come from a family that's cursed. That was a horrible feeling to have. And I never wanted my own daughters to feel that they came from a cursed family. Because that's, you know, we all have choice and we all have free will and we all have the ability to change things. It doesn't mean that you don't have depressed days. It doesn't mean that you don't have, you know, stuff to deal with, because we all do. But to put that under the blanket of being cursed is not part of their lives.
Are your daughters happy?
They are. I think so. Yeah, my youngest is an artist. Like literally, she does pen and ink and, you know, works with different modalities of painting and stuff. And so she is happy. It's fun to watch them both. My other daughter is a model and an actress and quite successful. They're both successful. And it's interesting to watch them in their creative expression and what moves them and how they go about orchestrating their own creativity and how it is defined differently than, you know, say it was for my grandfather or even for me early on in my life. So it's interesting. I find it fascinating to just watch them.
Do you think artistry, creativity, is on some level fundamentally destructive?
I would like to say no. I actually think creativity is not destructive. I think that we have created a world where creativity is defined by how much pain you go through. And that's a misinterpretation of artistry. And I think if my grandfather were around today, he would go, wow, I didn't have to suffer. I think he was part of creating that belief system of writers, especially, you know, they just have to suffer. They have to be on the razor's edge. They have to go, you know, they have to live in difficulty in order to create something that is worth something. And I don't think that he would believe that today. But that's, you know, that's my projection.
Well, I mean, your family is part of this artistic, and, you know, it goes back to Edgar Allan Poe and way before that of writers and creative people trying to find an American music, an American song, an American story, in American literature. I think today maybe we're more confused than ever about all of that.
Yeah, I think we are. I think that we are trying to redefine ourselves. And also we live in a world that's all about technology. And so it's very hard to figure out how you fit in that. You have to reinvent how you do things. It's just a different environment than it was. So I think we are confused as a culture to what creatively matters.
You know, after we spoke a couple of years ago, I went back and looked at some of your grandfather's writing, and it seemed to me there was a theme. You talked a lot about the theme of, you know, mental illness and depression in your family, but there's also a theme, I think, of tearing away taboos about speaking of things. I mean, it seems to me that his work was very much about throwing aside this repressed sense of masculinity and being sort of bold and upfront about it. It got him into all kinds of trouble. But you've continued that on some level.
Well, I think that I love that you say that, because he's been so misunderstood or mistranslated into this guy who was, you know, a man's man, and it was all about misogynistic behavior and all of that was a very gross interpretation of him. And I think you're absolutely correct that he was all about, like, going in there and really talking about things that people didn't talk about. Because if you look at his characters, they were struggling with real things that were taboo. And, thank you for saying that I'm carrying that on. The idea that we can be bold, and that we can talk about things that we're afraid of, so that we're not no longer afraid of them.
Well, congratulations for having two happy children. I mean, there's not much more that you would want than
right?
that.
I think so, too. That is pretty cool.
Mariel Hemingway, thank you so much.
Thank you for talking to me. This is awesome.
Mariel Hemingway is an Academy Award-nominated actress, author, and mental health advocate. That's all for today. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks for listening.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. Since then, New York Public Radio's rigorous journalism has gone on to win a Peabody Award and a DuPont Columbia Award, among others. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.